I've been well coached in proper pronunciations, and so before I forget them, I want to introduce Margaret Wisomerski, who is a distinguished and widely respected political scientist. And I thought as we came in that there's something that is to be said about our society in the fact that we have a great splurge of popular attention to a subject like the subject of today, Congress, the presidency, and the arts, and one collects numerous clippings and reports, and these tend to be done oftentimes on an instant basis, whether the reports or the discussions that go on in the Congress. But on the other hand, there are people who devote most of their career to the study of the problem and try to understand it and analyze it and discuss it. And it is with that in mind that as part of what we've been talking about with regard to governance at the Miller Center, we invited Dr. Wisomerski to join us for a discussion this afternoon. She is now a member of the senior staff and faculty of the Federal Executive Institute, the Washington branch. She was, until fairly recently, director of the public policy program at Georgetown University. She was born in Amsterdam, New York, did her work for the bachelor's and master's degree at Harper College, SUNY in Binghamton, New York. She received the doctorate degree at Cornell and taught at Cornell and Rutgers, and then at Georgetown, and now at FEI. But her credentials, if one qualifies the witness at the beginning of this discussion, her credentials for the topic for today are that beginning with fellowship awards from the NEA, National Endowment of the Arts, with the Lehman Fellowship and with the Faculty Fellowship at Rutgers, and then as a member of the Research Committee of the American Council of the Arts, and a member of the Conference Group on Cultural Politics and the Arts, she has stuck continuously to an analysis of the question of government and the arts, society and the arts, the relation of the arts to the whole of our quality of life. She's the author as well of a major treatise on the presidency, staffing the presidency, Roosevelt to Reagan. She's a member, as is Jim Young, of the presidency group of the American Political Science Association. She's either been the author or the editor of such works as Congress and the Arts, A Precarious Alliance, Art, Ideology, and Politics, and the Politics of the Arts, Nancy Hanks and the National Endowment of the Arts, in the book Entrepreneurs in Government. She has contributed working papers, and next week we'll do a reprise of some analysis on the independent sector movement in a meeting in Pittsburgh. So she's well qualified to address the subject that in this kind of discussion is very much on people's minds, but in terms of the long sweep of our trying to clarify our thinking about the arts, requires the kind of competence that she brings to the subject.
Oh, thank you very much. You've really done your homework. I didn't expect to have everyone know where I was born. At least you didn't say when.
At least I didn't say Holland.
That's true. That's true. Although I have gotten that. I'll say I was born in Amsterdam and they'll go, Holland? Mm-hmm. No, there's another one. In talking to Ken before this, we sort of came upon a way that I think about politics and government which I think makes it a very interesting topic to look at as a scholar interested in politics. It's not the usual field, and in fact, I rather stumbled into it because when I was in graduate school, public policy was the hot area. Everybody had to have a public policy field, and I couldn't see myself going into transportation policy or defense policy, but I did stumble upon a few people who were interested in cultural affairs at a point where things were sort of blossoming and had enough background and sort of a track record so that you could begin to get a sense of pattern or direction and sort of issues. But I was very fortunate in stumbling into this. I often tell people there is far more than meets the eye that is similar between politics and the arts. I don't think of politics as a science. I think of it as an art form. And we have all learned in the last decade or so that performance and sort of presentation is certainly a very large part of politics. So with that as sort of background, let me try to give you a few very broad stroke comments about government, presidents, Congress, and the arts, and then let you bring up issues that we could sort of see how they work themselves through, because as Ken points out, there have been inordinate amounts of press attention to this recently, not just the Helms controversy that's been going on through most of the summer, but this will come back at us within the next few months as the National Endowments for the Arts and Humanities face reauthorization hearings. There was a whole set of discussions now about the Fine Arts Commission in Washington and sort of shaping that in a way that has not really been a focus in the last decade. And if you remember, about a year or so ago, there was a very big public art controversy in New York City over tilted art. So you've got sort of public art, you've got arts programs, you've got advisory commissions, you have a whole set of issues that are sort of keep this percolating in the public consciousness. Since I'm going to talk about President's Congress and the arts, let's say a couple of things about the perspective of each of those institutions towards the arts, and then some lessons that they've learned from history, because one can kind of date continuous federal interest in the arts, really from 1965 and the establishment of the National Endowments for the Arts and Humanities. Before that, you had had a rather checkered history with another sort of blip in the graph, if you'd like, during the New Deal with the WPA programs and the Fine Arts Section and the Treasury Department, followed by a nadir again through the 40s and much of the 50s before we came back in the late 60s. But it's since 65 that we've had a continuous program that has really been focused on art support. I will not say cultural policy because it's an open question if we do have an articulated cultural policy. The people at the endowment will say we have a policy of support of the arts. That leaves open the question of defining what the arts are and how we know it when we see it, or even what function we want art to be performing in society. So that there is a public art support policy, but sort of a cultural policy, I think, is still a nascent question. From the presidential perspective, the arts have never been a high presidential priority. They've been highlighted once or twice as an attendant to other presidential interests. For Lyndon Johnson, the focus was education, humanities and arts tacked on as part of the educational thrust, but not as the focus per se. For Franklin Roosevelt, it was the labor and unemployment issue that was important. Artists were unemployed just like all kinds of other workers were, so it was an adjunct to that. Or as means to other ends. For instance, with President Reagan, the push to reduce big government, the push towards privatization, both made cultural affairs likely candidates, either for cutback or for privatization. For President Nixon, who turns out to be rather the presidential hero of the arts, it was really a sense of acquiring political capital using the arts as a method to acquire access to decision makers, opinion makers, and sort of image building. We can get back to that a little bit more because it's absolutely fascinating, sort of the kinds of things that key people into seeing that as a political capital tool. Now, for Congress, they've always treated the arts, and I will say always, as sort of post from 1932 on. They've treated the arts ambivalently. Congress has had its arts proponents and its arts antagonists. What you tend to see is rather a shift in the relative balance of these. in the late 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the antagonists of cultural affairs were in the predominance in Congress. You saw a set of efforts by proponents to try to percolate the issue, incubate it, build support, which finally crested when a window of opportunity opened in 1964-65 with Lyndon Johnson. But through most of the 40s and the 50s, it was the antagonists who had the upper hand, which meant that there was not support for an effort for federal involvement in cultural affairs. The opening wedge there was they were tied to public diplomacy. All right, international exchanges, the Fulbright program, some cultural exchanges, a sort of sense of the Cold War was a competition on many levels, military, economic, ideological, and cultural. I mean, it goes back to the sort of Jacksonian tradition that in some ways the merits of a democracy are known by the fruits of its people. And therefore, the intellectual production, the cultural production is just as important in this kind of ideological competition between different systems. Then, again, in the late 60s, the 70s, the support built in Congress. John Brademas could say in 1977, as majority whip, that the arts had become politically sellable in Congress. And on a bipartisan basis, now, just bipartisan, it is still tipping heavily Democratic, but there have always been Republican adherents so that you can argue it is not a partisan program. And in fact, every effort has been made not to let it simply be a partisan program in Congress. In the 80s, we seem to see a sort of seesaw. Sometimes the proponents seem to hold sway, sometimes the opponents seem to hold sway. It's a not consistent enough thrust in either direction. It's rather a holding action in Congress. Now combine that with relatively low presidential attention and emphasis, and you really do have a sort of status quo or a static picture through much of the 80s coming into the 90s. Now also in terms of statutory policy, what have we got to work with? Well, the enabling legislation is one of those wonderful congressional products of compromise and ambiguity. In fact, I sometimes tell students in a cultural policy course that rather than define what arts were, we came up with a shopping list. I mean, literally, the language of the statute says, definition of the arts is to include the following, but not to be an exclusive listing of everything that might be included. And it sort of lists, you know, music and opera and theater and goes down to interior design and fashion design and photography. And I mean, it's a shopping list. So, that's the first thing. But also the legislation tries to give you some sense of why are we getting involved in cultural affairs. And the sort of four reasons it comes up with is that although the arts are primarily a private and local concern, there is nonetheless a necessity and a validity to a federal partnership. In fact, it would be interesting, I think, someday to go back and figure out whether or not the arts might not be the first instance of that use of partnership, explicitly in a sense of public policy. Secondly, there was the argument that as an intellectual concern, it should have parity with science and technology. And that was the argument that was also used for the humanities. Third, that government probably had its primary role in fostering a climate that was conducive to the arts. It's an argument that comes back, say, in the Reagan administration's platform in 1980, where their platform on the arts starts out by saying that inflation is probably the single worst detriment to the health and the vitality of the arts in this country, and therefore anything the administration can do to cut back inflation will be an assist to the arts. Which is a valid argument, I'm not quite sure the most, but yes, in terms of the environmental context, it definitely has an effect on the climate for the arts. And fourthly, that cultural leadership is part of world leadership, and therefore we need to develop our cultural capital, in effect, as part of our world leadership activity. Now, what about the arts? What are we trying to foster? Well, creativity, excellence, and access paramount. Now, I might point out that this is almost the same thing that happens in almost every other industrialized country that has a cultural policy. They are concerned with excellence, creativity, access, and this is the one thing that goes unnamed, really, or implicit in our policy, and that's most of the countries have a concern with preserving their cultural heritage, the sort of natural cultural patrimony. There is not that kind of explicit concern in our sort of construct. It's there, but you really have to read between the lines. Now, that may be because we're a relatively young nation. It may be because we've always been preoccupied with progress rather than sort of looking backwards. It may just be an accident that the legislation was written at a time when preservation and sort of cultural heritage were just emerging in sort of the consciousness. So it didn't quite make the wording. Now, background. When we got into the arts policy business in, say, 1965, we had a background of some experience in this, mostly from the New Deal. And it really is fascinating that although probably there are maybe three people in Congress at this point and very few in the arts world themselves who can remember the New Deal experience and debates over arts affairs, it has become a resonant theme in all debates over cultural policy. The New Deal experience with the WPA, with the Fine Arts Project section of the Treasury Department, really left a very vivid kind of picture on the public scene, both for artists and for government. From the government side, it seemed to leave sort of three lessons, which people are always trying to integrate into how they mold government policy. One is that they became very convinced of the importance of artistic quality in legitimizing public patronage. I mean, there is not agreement that an artistic experience, aesthetic opportunity, is a public good, a merit good that everyone should have access to. Barring that kind of consensus, then there's sort of a fallback position that seems to say, if we're going to do it, it needs to be of the very best quality. That's how we justify doing it, that we are delivering a quality good to the public. So that any questions about the artistic excellence, and I mean, we don't even talk about quality, we talk about excellence most of the time, really raises questions about the legitimacy of government activity in that particular project or action. The recent Mapplethorpe show at the Corcoran, amongst other things that came up in that, were questions about, well, is photography really art? A, does it fit the definition or not? Then there were questions about, since it's a retrospective, there was a lot of variation in quality. And in fact, some of the pictures that were most controversial were very early in the artist's production. And one could argue that, in fact, they were not very good examples of the artistry. Those kinds of questions, when they come up, sort of become a double whammy. It's both content and it's the very core that you're legitimizing it with, which is excellence. Now, of course, excellence is going to be a real slippery slope to deal with, because artistic excellence is likely to be in the eye of the beholder. Trying to sort of merge and blend the artistic expert's perception of excellence and the public perception of excellence, perhaps even intelligibility at times, is going to be a very difficult thing to complement each other. Second maxim that they learned was that it was both difficult and yet important to integrate local variation and input into decision making. In the 60s, there was a great push towards putting public sculpture and murals in all kinds of public places and public buildings. And early on, this was often referred to as plop art. In other words, somebody just came in and plopped it someplace in the building or in the community, and nobody knew where it came from or what it was supposed to do or what it meant, but it was sort of being imposed on the community. That sense of non-involvement, of having taste sort of forced upon a community, creates all kinds of participatory problems. So you want to integrate that into the decision making, and yet that also means that you have to have an extremely flexible procedure to allow for different community variation, different kinds of structure, different tastes. In fact, even now with the apparent resolution of the Helms Amendment, the notion of having some kind of provision for accommodating public taste, i.e. on the adopted obscenity standard, is going to be a challenge, if not nothing else, to try to put into implementation. You know, how do you consult the community on this? Tilted Arc in New York was a wonderful example of this, right at the point where people became aware of the need for public involvement in the process. But it also points up questions about what kind of public involvement? How do you get the public involved? Who's the public? I mean, the public in that case the building and the people who work in it, the people who lived in the surrounding community. Was New York City the community? How do you define local community input? Then beyond that, how do you then ask for it? For instance, in Tilted Arc, which, are you all familiar with what Tilted Arc was? Tilted Arc was a piece of public art commissioned by the General Services Administration as part of their art and architecture program. It was done, Richard Serra, an artist who works in sort of minimalist Corten steel. Corten steel is the rusty steel. And this was a 120-foot long wall by 10-foot high, sort of slight arc that also was slightly off-center, made out of Corten steel that bisected the plaza of the federal building there. It was a very interesting work in that if you walked around it, it sort of seemed to move as you walked around it. I mean, the dimensions, the tilt, the kind of arc on it shifted visually as you walked around it. People in the building, however, thought of it as a rusty steel wall that collected garbage in front of the building and that interfered with their access in and out of the building. The artist at various points had said that he did it to accentuate the sterility and mundaneness of the environment in which it was put so that people would be aware of how awful their environment was. He succeeded in many ways. But of course, if you had to walk by this every day, it was not your idea of improving your environment. And it touched off literally a 7-year battle about whether or not it could be removed or not. And one of the things they did in this process was they had put up in the lobby of the building sort of a maquette of the buildings and what the piece would look like on it. And at another time, they had polled, staked out the plaza and strung string in between it to sort of cordon off, in effect, where the piece would be. All of which was totally inadequate for public input. Because when you see the piece itself, I mean, it is a piece of art that struck me as like a black hole. I mean, sort of light and color just sort of seemed to get absorbed into it. And it was totally and utterly solid. Staked out poles with string do not give you a sense of the mass there. A visual view from the 8th floor gives you the arc, does not give you the ground level impact of it. And that's what people needed. They needed to know exactly what they were getting into before their input would in fact be informed. You can have provisions for input, but it's sort of the quality of the input. Will they in fact know what they're getting involved in enough to make an informed decision or not? Now, realize that public art is probably the leading edge of this. In the last 25 years, between federal commissions, state commissions, city commissions, I think something like 21 states now have percent for art in public building programs, in effect. We have now commissioned over 25,000 pieces of public art. We are now beginning to confront the question of, well, how do we maintain it and preserve it? And if the physical environment changes, how do we move it if necessary? And in fact, that was one of the other things that came up with Tilted Arc, was that it was a site-specific work. In other words, it was integrated into the particular site it was supposed to appear in. It would not work theoretically, therefore, in any other site. And it was also, by contract, guaranteed perpetual exhibition on that site. Can you, in fact, do that? I mean, considering the rapidity with which our urban environment changes or our built environment changes, site-specific works may have a very particular kind of problem. And if government tries to shift, then you have problems about abrogation of contract coming up, not only freedom of expression, which is what the artists in Tilted Arc argued, that you destroyed the work, you censored it by moving it because it was site-specific. All right, so local input really needs to be accommodated in this process, and it's not going to be easy. The third maxim that came out of the New Deal was really that government probably should avoid direct ownership or responsibility in total for any work of art. If you own it, if you have commissioned it single-handedly, if you have produced it, it is an invitation to problems and controversy. In some cases, this was the case with the WPA art, when the Living Theater and the Living newspaper criticized public affairs and public officials. Here you were with a government-sponsored program critiquing government officials. It created all kinds of problems about whether or not that was accountable use and responsible use of public money or not. When the State Department bought, atypically, a show to travel through Czechoslovakia and Central Europe in 1949, usually they simply borrowed paintings from private collections and museums. This time they bought them. And they were going to send, I think it was 49 paintings on a multicultural tour. But some of the paintings, some people thought, were not particularly complimentary to the American way of life. There was one in particular that was a rather expressionistic, almost caricatured painting of, I think it was called the military-industrial complex. And the general who was the central figure in the picture was a absolute caricature. I mean, he was bloated. He was overly gregarious. He seemed to have his hand in every pie in the picture. That painting, in large part, really provoked a controversy about, is this the image of the United States we want circulating in Europe? And the controversy got so heated that not only was the exhibition pulled back, but the paintings were sold off as war surplus at 10 cents on the dollar because we did not want to have to own them anymore. I mean, that sort of signified an official seal of approval if we owned them. Tilted Arc raised the problems it did because government owned it. Once that work is commissioned, it becomes part of the federal government's property. And in fact, all of the pieces that the General Service Administration has commissioned in this way, it considers part of a national collection that it has been putting together over the roughly 20 years of the program. If somebody else owns it, you've only helped them. In other cases, and the way most of the endowment works, is that it responds to initiatives from out there in the community, out in the field, and it then becomes a junior partner, a small partner in any of those, so that the initiative, the responsibility, is at the very least shared, if not actually deflected, and the government is simply in a responsive and in some way certifying posture. So we've really learned that lesson very well, the sort of arm's length principle, which people sometimes talk about, of giving a buffer between the artwork itself and the government is a very important part of the way we've developed culture. Might also point out that in the sort of 25 years of the endowment's history, I would estimate probably 85% of the things that have become controversial have tended to be involved with individual artists over particular artworks. There's a whole catalog of these as they come through Congress. Periodically, Congress does the equivalent of a Golden Fleece Award in the arts. One of the famous first controversies was over an acknowledgement in a book by the author who had gotten a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts to write. Not that book, but to write. It was a fellowship to engage in being an author. Well, the author happened to be Erica Jong. The book happened to be Fear of Flying. And yes, and a number of congressmen brought this to the floor wondering why we're in the business of sponsoring pornography. There was also a wonderful exchange over what I think was referred to as a concrete poem by William Saroyan. All right, so the name should be okay, noted quality. But the poem rather was a one-liner that was called Light. And the entire poem was L-L-L-I-G-H-T-T-T-T, light. And some members of Congress said, this is poetry. And to which another member of Congress replied, yes, but it is one of the few poems I have understood. And of course, as Jesse Helms has shown us more recently, again, it's been individual works by individual artists that tend to be the bone of contention. Now, we see what's been happening is a deal has been struck, in effect, that says in order to respect the artist's freedom of expression, we will not try to specify the end product. We will give you a fellowship to sculpt, to paint, to write, but not to write a particular thing. It is not a commission. The problem there, though, is, again, the unpredictability of the end result. in quality, in content, in style. Even if it's good, it may be controversial. Not everything that is created will automatically come out well. Someone once estimated that the failure rate in the arts was probably 99%, that one out of every 100 attempts actually succeeds fully in what it is. You realize that puts government in a very risky business in trying to defend how it spends public money responsibly and accountably if it is confronting something that has a natural failure rate of 99%. So that's sort of been a bone of contention, how to deal with the individual artist. From the artist side, the sort of late WPA congressional hearings, which started out with the House Un-American Activities Committee investigating the ideological predispositions of some of the artists involved in the WPA programs, began to sensitize them not only to sort of censorship in the arts, but censorship of artists for non-artistic reasons. This was then heightened during the McCarthyite era, where again, artists were one group that was really targeted during the McCarthyite period, particularly writers, often in popular culture or commercial culture. But the message was not lost on the rest of the arts world. In fact, the State Department exhibit that I mentioned earlier was the reason why an interest group called Artist Equity was established to try to articulate artists' interests against exactly that kind of reaction from government. As another footnote, one of the first interest groups ever established in Washington was the American Institute of Architects, which was created exactly to protect their interests against government. Established, I think, in 1838, because the architects who would submit plans for government buildings, remember this part of the early big Washington building boom, would find themselves with the government saying, well, I like the rotunda from your plan and the facade from your plan and the general layout of your plan, and they would hand all three plans to a construction engineer and say, put them together. And no one would get the commission, and everybody's work would be tampered with. Hence, again, protection from government for sort of misuse of artistic property, if you'd like. But by the time you got really to the 50s, what you had was a standoff that was very guarded on both sides. Politicians and policymakers looked at artists and said, these people are difficult to deal with, they're unpredictable, they are likely to incur high political costs for low political payoff, at far arm's length as possible. And the artists looked at government and said, again, for what I may get out of government in terms of support, I may pay too high a cost in my own independence, and it's probably not worth it. So what we did was have a system of kind of indirect support. It filtered through the tax system. It filtered through smaller programs that had foreign policy impacts or were building programs, architectural kinds of programs, design programs. During much of the 50s, much of our artistic concern was about postage stamps, buildings, and coins. Now again, in some ways this is not really small. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, I used to be a stamp collector. And postage stamps can be very interesting kind of international messengers. And I mean, if you look at our old postage stamps from the 40s, the 50s, they are dull. You know, we often used to hear about, you know, the wonderful stamp from Liechtenstein and Luxembourg, you know, with the 14 colors in it. And we've gotten very much better on it. We've also started commemorating all kinds of cultural effects and artists in stamps. The whole series on architecture, on performing artists, even the recent controversy over whether or not we should have a stamp on Elvis Presley or not. And you realize that the controversy got into a discussion about, was this a valid role model for Americans or a projection of Americans or popular heroes that here is a person who probably died of a drug overdose. I mean, do we want this person immortalized on our stamps? Again, things tend to rise to very high levels of abstraction when you start talking about the arts. But what that meant then was that for the 16 years between the end of the 40s and 1965, Congress and the President both were in a process of developing enough support to try to reapproach those issues. They did so in 1965 with the establishment of the endowment. it took the whole decade of the 70s to develop sort of a policy sub-government or system. Realize that when government got into this version of arts support, the arts community was very disorganized, relatively small compared to today, and not at all sure whether it wanted government support. In fact, the Symphony Orchestra League campaigned against the National Endowment for the Arts. Actors Equity campaigned for it, ASCAP did. There were no opera companies to talk about as an interest group, or dance companies. I mean, there were seven of them. You didn't need an association, you needed a conference phone call. That's all that it would take to organize it. But on the other side as well, there was no superstructure underneath a federal arts policy. There are now arts councils in all 50 states and all the territories. There are something like 2,000 local arts councils below that at the municipal, county, and state level. So what you have had happen is that the entire sort of intergovernmental system has developed, again, in large part spurred by federal government action. Federal government included in their establishment of a federal policy a sort of seed grant for any state that would have an agency that could administer the funds to funnel funds down to the state level. This then grew to a line item of 20% of the national budget should filter through the states to be used at sort of at a state block grant level for artistic activities in that state. Most states have now incorporated a similar sort of trickle-down block grant theory for the local levels. Sometimes it's decentralized even on a county per capita basis, and there's a formula of funding that goes with this. But that whole system did not exist in 1965. It's grown up since then. Interest groups, outside of the unions, the museums, and orchestras who had groups, but they were not political interest groups at that point. The whole interest group system, a constituency for the arts, has been mobilized again, largely from the top down. The NEA has funded all of those interest groups to provide services to the field, not to be lobbyists, but in the process develop organizations that then can be galvanized when necessary to mobilize that constituency. And by 1981, when the first Reagan administration came in and threatened a 50% cut in the National Endowment for the Arts, it proved just how effective that interest group's sort of constituency could be. I sometimes also think that it is probably one of the few constituencies very well suited to fight off the great communicator. I mean, who else has access to the media, to sort of the drama, the theater, the celebrityness, to be able to counter on exactly those grounds? Also, the congressional support system developed in the 70s. From a few scattered supporters like Frank Thompson and Charles Howell and Hubert Humphrey and John Lindsay and Jacob Javits, you really developed committee chairmen and subcommittee chairmen strategically located with stability and seniority who became your primary strategic congressional advocates for this policy. Claiborne Pell in the Senate, who has chaired the subcommittee on arts, humanities, and higher education since its inception in 1964. John Brademas, who then handed it off to Paul Simon, who then handed it off to Pat Williams currently, the relevant similar committee in the House, and first Julia Butler Hansen, and then Sidney Yates now as the Appropriations Subcommittee Chair. Okay, all of them sort of commanding key gates that concern the agency and federal cultural policy, as convinced advocates with stability and seniority to really protect the arts. And again, you saw this in the recent Yates debate. I mean, without sort of Yates, particularly Yates in this case, and Pat Williams being strategically located to fight this on the House floor, the arts would have had far more difficulty than they have through the last sort of 4 to 6 months. Also, the agency itself grew tremendously. It was probably one of the biggest domestic growth success stories of the Nixon administration. It went from a budget of $7 million in 1969 to a budget of $132 million in 1977. I mean, there were year after year in which its budget doubled. I mean, it was just a geometric progression. There were very few agencies that did this. Part of this was due to an alliance formed between the agency head, Leonard Garman on the White House staff, who then convinced President Nixon of the utility of sponsoring the arts for very low political cost, but a lot of political payoff and good press. In fact, this is one of the areas in which President Nixon probably felt most comfortable with the press, because he was getting credit, he was looked upon favorably, he felt comfortable with this group. It struck me the other day, too, this is probably the last president who seriously addressed an arts group. In 1969, President Nixon went to a meeting of the American Association of Museums and sort of told them of his plan for the development of cultural policy in the country. I cannot think of another president who has addressed anything like a similar group in the succeeding sort of practically 20 years now. And the fact that you had the White House linkage so well developed, even the assistant budget director at that time, Cap Weinberger, was part of this coalition at the White House complex. At one point, remember, this is Cap, the knife at the Budget Bureau, who wanted to cut virtually everything, particularly on the domestic side. And yet he's on record as saying that if we need to cut back government, there are at least innumerable other candidates rather than the arts, and I'd rather spend the money on the arts. I think there it's at least well spent. I mean, if you can get the budget director on your side on this kind of argument as well, then you have a very potent sort of White House linkage. And again, bipartisanship really developed during these years. You had both sides of the avenue supporting the arts. The final piece that came in on the congressional side was the establishment of the Congressional Arts Caucus in 1980, late 1980, January of 1981. The Congressional Arts Caucus is now one of the largest caucuses in the House of Representatives. It has, on average, between 150 and 170 members. Now, that's a quarter or slightly better of the House membership. And it grew up largely as a defensive reaction against the incoming Reagan administration. You know, they had a sense that the arts were going to be on the hit list, and they needed to mobilize more effectively to protect that interest. If that's what happened during the 70s, in other words, the whole system developed, it proliferated in terms of what kind of art it supported, at what levels, with a sort of variable excellence criteria, that it wasn't just high Western European art that was the standard, but that we started recognizing sort of other cultural pluralities, if you'd like. Ethnic cultures, remember this is the era of roots. This is the backwash of the counterculture movement of the 60s. It's a revigoration of the folk arts movement. All of this is incorporated into how we administered cultural policy, which was possible considering it was an age of great budget growth. Problems start hitting in the 1980s. Budget stagnates, if not declines slightly. You have had a tremendous boom in arts production, in artists, in arts organizations in the country. Again, let me give you just some sense of dimension. Someplace in the 60s versus someplace in the early 80s. I mean, the dates change a little bit for each art form. In the early 60s, there were 44 professional orchestras in the country. By the early 80s, there were 161. In the early 60s, there were 7 professional opera companies. By the 80s, there are 81. There were 35 dance companies in the early 60s. There are now 325. Your arts audience has exploded, tripling, quadrupling, in some cases even more. The opera audience went from about 2.5 million to about 11 million. The theater audience went from about 4.5 million to about 14 million. The dance audience went from essentially being in the New York City metropolitan area at 1 million to being 16 million nationwide. When you start talking about this, you realize sort of just what kind of proliferation has happened being administered under this policy. Now, this isn't to say that federal policy is responsible for this, but it was catalytic in important ways, joining with other forces to proliferate this way culturally. But it also meant that by the time you get to the 80s and you have stagnant budgets, you have increased demands on those budgets. And how do you satisfy them? It's fine to say you will have a pluralistic, everybody in many different ways of assuming excellence while you have enough money to deal with it. Once the pie stops growing and in fact starts constricting, then you've got to start setting some kind of priorities, making some kind of distinctions. And that's exactly what the endowment has spent much of its time not doing. That's why we have a policy in support of culture, not a cultural policy, because that would assume some kind of prioritization, some kind of choices this more than that, this before that, and we haven't gotten there yet. It's probably someplace percolating up now. We're going to have to get to it, but it's not there yet. All right. Let me just finish with this and some forces for possible change. Maybe one reason we notice this with the Helms kind of argument with Tilted Art is that we have become a more culturally, despite Professor Hirsch, literate society. I mean, we have spent 25 years getting more of the arts out to more people in more parts of the country. Even though your arts audience looks very much the way it used to, in the sense that it is well-educated, middle and upper class, professional, high, middle and high SES status. You have to realize the real key to that is educational attainment. The more educated you are, the more likely you are to be an arts participant. Well, we've also spent 20 years proliferating opportunity to education and higher education, so that the same pool now actually is more diverse than it was 20 years ago. It has to be bigger. I mean, given those audience figures, it has gotten bigger, and it's gotten geographically more distributed than it used to be. So there is more attention to these kinds of issues. There is a built-in sort of public for some of this. People may not vote on the basis of their preference or their sense of cultural policy and where congressmen or federal officials stand on it, but they're aware of these things happening at a different level than they used to. When arts policy was small, it was largely invisible. Maybe when it passed the $100 million mark, which it did with the endowment in the mid-70s by 1976, it stopped being invisible. Now, not yet high stakes, but no longer invisible. So it has a different kind of attention. And also, the arts, like themselves, betray an effort to high personality. There's a lot of individualistic impact. I mean, the arts are a wonderful example of sort of, indifferent to the arts, and you'll have quite different system. Change the leadership at key agencies, and you can have a quite different impact. It's not just the environment that really controls the process. Okay, changes that one might want to think about. The rise of symbolic politics. Congress now spends one-third of its legislative production on symbolic measures. National Postage Stamp Week, National Apple Day, stamps, medals, commemoratives. Virtually a third of Congress's production is in this symbolic genre. The arts fit very nicely into this kind of form of symbolic politics. In large part, the Helms controversy really is a discussion at the symbolic level. I mean, people are not seriously, really concerned with $45,000 spent on two different exhibitions as really the focus of attention. It's the stand-in for a much higher symbolic and almost ideological debate that's going on. And as I said before, it's a symbolic level argument or discussion that goes on multiple levels. On a political ideological level and symbolism about the correct or proper reach, jurisdiction, involvement of government, limited activist, interventionist, reactive, that whole set of issues happens there, private action or public responsibility, and also on an aesthetic ideological level. I mean, we get into wars of taste very easily. And again, Ken and I were talking about this beforehand, and when I thought about all of the kind of nonprofit activities, which is mostly the arts we're talking about in this sense, the supporters of it are called benefactors or supporters. It's only in the arts that you use the word patron. All right? And what patron carries is not only the connotation of a supporter, but of an advocate. I mean, when you think about it, I mean, people will very easily get into a defense of what they like and what they don't like and what they think is beautiful and what they think is ugly and what they think is offensive very quickly. Now, in some ways, that way it has a relationship to sort of democratic participatory senses. One has a sense, just like in politics, that I have a right to my opinion, maybe more or less informed, but I have a right to my opinion. In art, it's the same way. I have a right to my opinion, maybe more or less informed. The phrase of, I may not know what it is, but I know what I like, I mean, there is a normative connotation in that that very quickly goes into an ideological debate. And in an era of symbolic politics, you have a ripe environment for those kinds of debates. Second, you do have a now federal policy structure that is 25 years old. The world has changed drastically around this. I mean, the emphasis, the quality, the amount. I mean, 25 years ago, the United States was one of a number of leaders in some cultural fields. In many ways, the United States has become the cultural leader. There was a wonderful book that came out last year about how New York stole the idea of modern art from Paris. That was the title. The sort of European sort of shift, we have taken on leadership in many ways. In an era of glasnost, this kind of leadership is going to take on a different kind of importance even. The sort of intergovernmental structure. Maybe we simply need to adjust the structure. It's 25 years old. Most things that were built 25 years ago, need some kind of revision or revamping or something. Maybe we need to revisit the structure and fine-tune it. For instance, individual artists. Maybe now one needs to devolve that activity more to the local level. I mean, it is in many ways unrealistic and excessive to expect a national panel of 15 or 20 people in Washington in a 3-day period to screen 10,000 literary applications for fellowships from all over the country, read materials from 10,000 different people, have a sense of what all these 10,000 people are doing to award, 700 fellowships for a grand total of about $3 million. I mean, that's not a very cost-effective, nor really in tune with what's happening in the field process. I mean, maybe we need, now that we've got the structure, to devolve that down to the state or maybe even a local level more closely. Third thing to keep sort of an eye on, divided government. It's sort of interesting that we finally mobilized enough consensus in the 60s with unified government. I think it's a tribute to Nancy Hanks' leadership in the endowment that during the 70s, with divided government, she managed to mobilize both sides of the avenue and keep that going. But since then, divided government has complicated their cultural policy no end. It compounds the ambivalence in Congress. It weakens even the already weakened presidential leadership, so that trying to get a sense of national perspective in a sense of divided government really compounds the political divisions with the aesthetic divisions. Okay, and lastly, there is sort of a more integrated sense of the impact of cultural affairs, I think, developing. It's developing sort of piecemeal, but it's sort of there. Remember, we've seen the rise of the service economy, the sort of rise of symbol specialists and sort of intellectual property specialists. That's everybody from university faculty through lawyers, through scientists, anybody who deals with ideas and services more than products. The artists fit right in there, plus globalism. I mean, except for some of the verbal arts. The arts, one of the arguments for supporting that during the Cold War and for a long time has been that they transcend national boundaries, that they allow for a sort of individual personal connection across national differences. As globalism really picks up speed, as the service economy picks up speed, and as we notice that cultural products are one of our best export products, I mean, not just, you know, the high arts, which is exportable, but the commercial arts. I mean, I think it's fascinating that you watch European unity coming in 1992, and what's one of the first trade issues that hits us? That they're trying to impose a quota for domestic European production on television, radio, and movies in Europe. And what this is going to do to America's market in Europe for exactly those products. All right, that kind of realization that the arts are not just, you know, sort of this frill, but that they have these economic components, these sort of service economy, sort of social components, these international components, maybe coalescing into, again, a different sense of how we treat cultural affairs. And in that sense, we are behind virtually every other, at least developed country in the world. I can't speak for the developing country. But virtually every other country in the world has a Ministry of Cultural Affairs, maybe with education, maybe with tourism, but they have that as a governmental focus. Virtually every other country in developed country in the world spends more on cultural policy than we do. And that means not only Western Europe and Japan, but that also means Eastern Europe, the Soviet Union, China. All right, so that it's not just with our friends, but it's with our competitors in many ways, that this is an issue in which we are mismatched. So let me leave it there and hope that that's sort of raised more issues than I can deal with.
Who would like to begin the discussion? Is the first question.
I'll begin the discussion. It's not exactly a question. Certainly in architecture and in other areas, commercial art, the artist is commissioned to do a job, and his function is to produce something that his employer wants to have. Mm-hmm. And the employer retains a censorship, as it were, over the product. Now we've had, I think this Tillet Art thing was extreme, and it was just dumb on everybody's part. But you have in New York a way out piece of sculpture at 140 Broadway, and then a block over at the Chase Plaza. And in Chicago, you have one that right beside the post office in a big plaza, where you had something that could be accommodated. It was the degree of sensitivity, and I don't think anybody 5 years later has complained about any of those three. In fact, many people like them very much. But this is, again, a matter of quality, applying the product, as it were, to the particular scene and the particular need. Mm-hmm. And I don't see why an artist has a right to impose his own ideas in a public scene that belongs to the public. And to have the state, in effect, demand that this be put in front of everybody's eyes, I think it's ridiculous. Now, if somebody wants to fund something like that privately and put it in a barn someplace, that's okay. But to force it on the public, I think is ridiculous. I think going back a few years, Rockefeller had it done very nicely when he removed the Diego murals. Now that, I think they're fine where they are down in Mexico City, but in New York, they certainly weren't very big.
Well, you raise a host of really interesting points. Tilted Arc, you're right, is excessive. It is the only case that I know that went on for as long and that did not really sort of reach a resolution, but that had to be arbitrated in effect. In most cases, it's a matter of reaction to something new, moderately alien, that you weren't quite prepared for and that you often don't understand on first glance, and it sort of settles in and people learn to understand it. In fact, one of the first public art pieces was in Grand Rapids, Michigan, put in 1967 by Alexander Calder. When it first came in, people were not at all sure what they thought of it. By 10 years later, it had become the city logo on everything from stationary, garbage trucks, cars, I mean everything. It was on everything in the city, and they had sort of adopted it as sort of, you know, their mascot in effect. Usually it's a settling in process. And in fact, you could probably avoid a lot of this if you engage in more public education efforts. I mean, I remember reading some of the reviews of Tilted Arc about how it sort of had the projection and the power of an old locomotive cutting across the prairie. I'm sitting there going, well, I suppose I could stretch my imagination and see that, but it would not be the first thing that occurred to me. In fact, the first thing that would occur to me as I crossed the street over the subway construction was to notice exactly the same material in the ground that I was walking on that was a nuisance and an obstruction being up there on the plaza as art. And I'm sure that, again, the environment, you know, in an urban setting, one other big obstructive thing is, you know, like the last straw. In a more open setting, one can appreciate it quite differently. But you raise also a point about public art, which, again, we haven't really talked about. We talk about a public art policy. We talk about public art being sculpture in public places. But is there something about, if you are creating art for public patronage, for public consumption, do you have a responsibility as an artist, as a citizen, to consider public sensibilities or not? And we haven't confronted that question. Now, I see in the public art movement, maybe because they've been on the front line here, sort of a shift going on, in which the sort of model of the alienated, rebellious, radical artist, as sort of the role the artist played, and sort of public opinion be damned, they don't understand what I'm doing anyway, and if they did, they're Philistines, and I would be horrified if they liked and knew what I did, and I'm caricaturing, but nonetheless close enough to reality. I mean, and again, Richard Serra said practically most of these same things over Tilted Art. But in the public artists, there is now a whole movement of artists of the sort of next generation that really is concerned with communicating with the public. They're not there to assault, insult, or, you know, sort of confuse the public. They want to communicate with them. There is a sense of trying to enhance the environment, not simply illuminate it in ways that may not be particularly amenable or hospitable to the public. There is a different shift going on here. I think also that as you pull back out of modernism and even postmodernism, I think we're now in post-postmodernism, we still don't know what to call it, that there is more of a variation, there's less of a strict canon, so that people can do different things that will communicate on different levels easier and still have sort of the judgment of the art world. The third thing you raise is about commercialism, or sort of at least not really commercialism. It's the fact that artists who work in the commercial realm are accustomed to at least acknowledging patron input and wishes. And it's ironic that, again, in the United States, as we got into public support for the arts, it's as though we said, you couldn't do that. I mean, forever, since the pyramids, the popes, everybody has had to acknowledge and in some way accommodate the ideas and the tastes of the patron. I mean, that's always been the case. How we managed to go from that system that has been sort of historically the case into an assumption that because public support in the United States would be provided, that it should not have any of that kind of control or, I won't even say control, input over the product is sort of an odd kind of way of balancing, in effect, the First Amendment. Now, it's really saying that artistic freedom of expression can go into license if on occasion, and that there is no recourse of sort of public accountability on it. I mean, and this is the tension that Helms was bringing up. Again, it tends to be at the wrong ends of the dimension. I mean, I think of it as sort of, if there's a middle ground, there's sort of freedom of expression and government accountability. Both of them are valid principles. At the excess of government accountability is censorship. At the far reaches of freedom of expression is license. What happens is the debate happens out here, or it happens with, let me say, one reasonable perspective and one unreasonable perspective. So you can never get a particularly productive dialogue going. People are not talking on the same wavelength. And it's unfortunate that it happens that way, but I really do think that we haven't confronted the issue of whether in public art there is not a responsibility on the artist as well as on the public to be as open of to expression and difference as possible. The artist part to try to be responsible and accommodating or at least acknowledging public input and taste as well. I mean, that's part of the patronage-patron sort of equation. And we've ignored much of that.
General Bisson and then Victor Yonke.
Can't we accommodate it to go to those basic principles you said between freedom and license? And could we not, and since art basically has to be creative and have free expression, couldn't we reach both of those by doing these things? Instead of having all these difficult to administer grants of one kind or another, have substantial awards, then that 1% you mentioned, which is good, could be rewarded that way with government money. And that would take care of the free thinkers and the creative people. Then the other one that you mentioned goes along with it, that we commission certain things, and on those because we're putting out the money, we demand standards, and well, it's a patron's viewpoint that we get what we pay for. And it seems to me those two things could go side by side and accomplish both objectives.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the commissioning process has certain attractions. It may not be less administratively cumbersome, because what typically happens with commissions is you have to get into competitions. All right, with submissions, and so that it's an open competition, and the architects are used to this. That requires a great upfront investment of the artist, even to get into the competition, and may not reach fruition, all right? The second thing that happens is that then government is more identified with the product. How do you really control the artist in terms of getting exactly what you thought you were getting in the commission? All right, for instance, and I mean, again, look at something like the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. All right, we knew it, we saw it on paper, we had done the competition, we put it up, and nobody was really prepared for the kind of reaction that it got. And in fact, some kind of accommodation had to be worked out after the fact. But even with commissions, you're not always sure of avoiding some of the problems that you get in the other process. The creative sort of high achievement awards. There are prototypes of that in other countries. Ireland does it. Japan does it with its National Treasures Awards, which I think is absolutely fascinating that they've now tried to start what they call sort of the artistic equivalent of the Nobel Awards. I mean, it's an absolute extrapolation of Japanese National Treasures kind of funding processes. And we've talked about that in this country. It's never gotten very far. But sort of that there are national institutions or people that are really sort of national treasures, if you like. The problem with that is the distributive politics of it. If I asked you, give me the top 10 candidates that come to your mind for the national treasures as institutions. Okay, let's not start to try people at the moment, just institutions. You start sort of saying, well, the Metropolitan Opera, which is the paramount institution in the country culturally. Then you start talking about museums, and there'll be the Smithsonian, and probably the Metropolitan, the Boston Fine Arts, and the Institute for Fine Arts in Chicago. You start going down the line, you realize that there are going to probably be 400 congressmen in the House real upset that there's no treasure in their district, and there's probably going to be about 40 probably about 80 senators who will be equally upset. And the politics then, distributively, of going the national treasures route raises all kinds of other issues. The third thing that's not
talked on that, the Nobel Prize has the same, that of course, you're not going to be problem-free no matter what you do.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with all those difficulties, but they don't seem insurmountable at all.
Well, in fact, they may be less insurmountable than they were 20 years ago, because we have pushed down arts activity so far across the country and sort of nurtured it for 20 years now that it may be a more equal competition than it used to be. It's also a device that is possible. For instance, New York State, what they have done is they've taken the state arts support and they sort of divided it in half. And they said half of it goes to what they call the 50 premier institutions in the state. All right, and they have some kind of formula, or they have project support, but they allocate it between those 50. The other 50% goes to all of the counties on a per capita formula basis to sort of nurture sort of the developing the smaller, the individual artists, so that you've sort of done both simultaneously. It may be workable. Individual artists probably near the end of their career or well into their careers, you could probably have sort of national lifetime achievement awards, which would make a certain sense. For instance, I can make a very good case for something like that late in an artist's career to take care of a problem that came up about 3 years ago with Martha Graham, who tried to bypass the endowment grant route and went directly to Congress to lobby for a line item allocation of, I think it was $4 million, to create a film archive of her repertoire. Now, Martha Graham is 93 or 94 years old. Dance has a particular problem with sort of preservation. I mean, at this point, you need to film it, and you need to film it well with all kinds of annotation if you're going to preserve it. And she was fought by the artistic community for sort of bypassing sort of the peer procedure and sort of dividing ranks if possible, so that everybody would then rely on who had the best lobbying access, all right, and it would be all against each. But if you had lifetime achievement awards, that's exactly where you could get something like that taken care of, to preserve the artistic output of an artist late in their career to make sure that it was in fact preserved as part of the cultural patrimony. I mean, those kinds of things I could see a real argument developing for. Maybe that's one of the things we want to consider. But the thing that I see left out of your sort of two ends is sort of the performance and presentation set. You've got the creative artist, and then you've got, what was your other alternative to the creative?
Commercial.
Patron.
Commission.
Okay, commission, which is sort of product specific, okay? But that sort of leaves out the whole performance exhibit sort of culture. Now, maybe that can be accommodated, but that's, see, the problem with talking about the arts is very hard to say anything that you can diversify across all the art forms. What may work for writers, sculptors, painters, may not work for choreographers, theater groups, opera companies, and symphony orchestras. I mean, you really do have this problem of sort of generalizing across the different art forms.
Can't that be left to the public? After all, for many years before the 60s, we did it that way.
Mm-hmm.
They had local symphonies. We have them here in Charlottesville. We've got arts and whatnot, and it seems to me that's the way to get, let the government have a limited role and let art develop locally.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and in that case, then what probably the best thing the federal government or government can do is to really get on to arts education. I mean, because if you really want to proliferate and encourage private, you know, individual and local support, the key barrier then is sort of equal access and opportunity and knowledge of the possibilities. And that's really a matter of arts education. We've gotten worse about that in probably the last decade or two decades as sort of extracurricular activities get budgeted out of school curriculums because of budget constraints. We've never had a sense of what the curriculum requirements in K through 12 should be on for arts education. We've never even had a consensus on who should do it, whether it should be artists coming into the schools or it should be arts and drama educators in the schools doing it. And then add to that sort of multicultural aspect. What do you teach them about art? What kind of art do you cover? It's a long-term strategy. I think that's absolutely the way to go. You increase your audience, you increase your patrons, you increase your artists, you increase your sort of grassroots support for the arts, and you also increase your public support for any policy that there is for the arts. But it would take a generation to get there. You know, what do you do in the meantime?
What do you do with, how many saw the piece about the Jupiter Symphony in Nygaard, this fellow who appeared from nowhere and slept on a park bench for quite a while in New York City and just about gave up, and then finally Rockefeller gave him a grant. But the trouble with symphonies always is that one day of rehearsal with Bartok costs about the annual budget for the arts of the Rockefeller Foundation, and so you almost need government money. But he was a big, big question mark, wasn't he? And now he's on everybody's list.
Well, it's like the overnight discovery, who in fact has been working for 10 years or something, unsung and unnoticed, and suddenly bursts out onto the public consciousness. There's a difficult sort of complex of problems when dealing with that kind of question or with the rehearsal question. I mean, the arts are one of the few, I would almost say, guild industries left in the world. They are so labor intensive and so cost ineffective that to maintain the kind of quality that you need to justify public support is an extremely expensive proposition. In fact, some people are saying that in the artistic community, being caught between needing to be publicly responsive and commercially self-supporting, at least to the extent that they can, they are creating an artistic deficit. All right, in order to avoid the financial deficit, they're creating an artistic deficit. So that what you're, and if you take this argument a little bit farther, it seems to say the arts are almost being self-censorious in the sense that they pick repertoire or projects in terms of their cost sort of profile. You see it in, say, dance. Balanchine, in some ways, was very successful in establishing himself because he kept costs down for years. And he kept costs down because he would do abstract ballets with little or no scenery and little or no costumes or sort of minimal costumes. Modern dance does the same thing. Theater companies will do this in the sense of you don't see a lot of big costume classics anymore. They're too expensive in terms of cast, in terms of sets, in terms of costumes. And if they do it, they all do the same thing, sort of in sort of three-year cycles. Somebody once did a survey that said that out of all the Shakespeare done any sort of one season by all the regional theater companies, 50% of those productions would be Othello, 25% would be Macbeth, and probably 15% would be Romeo and Juliet. Shakespeare wrote a lot of other plays. But those are the three that get done because everybody then shares scenery and costumes and sort of circulates it. And it minimizes costs for everybody. For symphonies, you don't do a lot of new music, contemporary music, because it's very difficult. You require rehearsal time. Rehearsal time's expensive. So you don't do a lot of it. It's also not the most attractive to your general audience. You put it on the program and your subscriptions fall off for that series. People won't come to it. You know, unless you make a really concerted effort and a long-term investment in cultivating audiences this way and bringing them along to understand what this music is with the kind of quality rehearsal to really deliver it at the sort of quality level you want to, you've got a built-in disadvantage. And so you're creating this artistic deficit, particularly with contemporary artists, that you're not introducing them and promoting them enough in the repertoire so that they acquire sort of the kind of recognition and audience that they really need to survive. And I mean, your example, I mean, he was probably lucky to get it performed. The real catch is not the first performance for a contemporary symphonic composer, it's the second and the third and the fourth. Because you can get it on the program once, and you're part of the new American music theory. Problem is getting other people to hear it and hear it again. You know, so they become familiar with the music. And that's the more difficult problem. And part of that is simply the dynamics of the industry. It is terribly cost inefficient.
May I say something?
Yes.
Going way back to the time of, Beethoven, Bach, and all the artists, a lot of them had a hard time. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that we had any deficit of artistic output because they had to sue somebody else. And I can't believe that an artist at some time, I know that there were people like Mozart, that as long as I'm talking about them, who were unappreciated in his time. But I don't see how you're going to ever have anything where there isn't going to be some kind of public response. And if it doesn't hit people, I don't think you can, you can't have the government say, this is what you've got to have, and we think it's good, and you take it, you know.
You will learn to like this.
Yeah, right. And I was very interested in hearing George Shulman once talking about Bruckner, and he said he did not like it. George Shulman did not like Bruckner, and a friend of his said, you must listen, you must persist, and he did persist, which made me feel very good because I thought if George Shulman has to be told to listen before he likes Bruckner, it's all right for me not to like some of the others, you know.
Well, in fact, I've even heard some music critics kind of say that new music for them is very difficult, that they not only have to listen to it sort of 10, 20 times with the score in front of them so that they can start to understand it, and that the average audience member is not going to invest this much time and energy. I mean, this is something who makes a profession out of trying to keep track and understand that kind of production, but you're right. However, that point has come up at congressional hearings where artists have been testifying, and generally their first comment is to say there is no necessary connection between being starving and being creative. They'd like to be at least a moderately well-fed, housed artist and still be creative. They don't think that would really dry up their creativity. But you're right. Artists have, again, historically and forever subsidized their own production until they catch on, and sometimes they never catch on, or they catch on after they've died. I have to admit there's a certain irony to all of this brouhaha over Robert Mapplethorpe. What is it, 6 months, 8 months after he's died? I mean, he is now infinitely more famous than he ever was in life. He's caught on sort of a bit too late for himself. But that problem is always there, and artists do subsidize themselves, whether it's driving taxis or waiting tables or teaching in universities. They do. And if it catches on, then they sort of get into a different category. And that's not something new, and I'm not sure that the government has necessarily a responsibility to guarantee a minimum quality of life for artists, but if it guarantees a minimum quality of life for its citizens, then it should include the artists.
One more question, Victor Yemke.
It's a matter of interpretation of viewpoint. Recently, the French government gave Richard Serra meritorious honor.
Uh-huh.
The Japanese government has commissioned him. And my other thing I'd like to raise is the National Film Board films from Ottawa. They're generally handled only by National Public Television. And 2 or 3 years ago, or within the last 2 or 3 years, they have produced, and for those who don't know about the National Film Board, it's an independent agency of the Canadian government. It is not part of the government at all. But they couldn't show those films on National Public Television during the last administration unless they had the writer. This is propaganda. And they couldn't do that. No, where can we, I mean, that's an administrative decision.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that at least that is not prior censorship. That is sort of after the fact judgment. It may not have been able to be shown on Canadian television, but at least it was produced. I think much of our debate ends up on being at an earlier point of intersection of government involvement and perhaps stoppage. But I think you're right, and there is an odd kind of thing over the Sarah sort of perception in Europe and in Japan. Even though the United States is now a cultural leader in many arts fields, we often don't sort of, if you'd like, value our own profits in this country unless they've been validated elsewhere. I mean, now that's been shifting somewhat. And again, other people will have different sort of senses. The Japanese, I could see, being much more attuned to Sarah's work because it is minimalist. And there being a whole tradition of minimalism in Japanese art that this could sort of resonate from. I could make a cultural argument for that. But there is a problem with the United States, especially in high culture, having a sense of, well, yes, we're still leaders, but we're not quite sure it's really, really good unless it's been praised in Europe. I mean, for years, opera singers were that way. I mean, Beverly Sills is one of the few American opera singers who actually made her career in the United States and then exported it, but stayed mostly in the United States. Most American singers have to make a name in Europe first and then come back home. And then they're okay, they've been legitimized. To some extent, conductors for a large time had been the same way. They had to come from Europe. Even at the Met, the current administration that's just coming in now, with James Levine and Hugh Southern coming in as the new executive director, will be the first American administration of America's premier cultural institution in probably 30 or 40 years. I mean, at least since before the time of Rudolph Bing. I mean, and that says something about the way we sort of validate what we think is really excellence in the art and where it gets validated.
Final question, Howard.
One of the things that intrigues me is how some of our music, popular music, rock music, that some of us of our generation look askance about. And we think transporting it abroad doesn't give us a good image. Seems some way to be very popular. I'm so surprised when the Russians, through their new policy of last month, these artists from America that we don't prize highly go in there and have sold-out houses. And I listened to some of the British PBS movies and so on. I hear songs that I know were composed in America. And yet this all goes on apparently by osmosis almost, without any effort on our part to transport it.
Well, actually, you raise really another issue which I should include in my list of things that are likely to change or that you need to watch is change element. The fact that so much of American culture is in fact exported, but it's what we think of as commercial or popular culture. And then there's sort of this other wave that is sort of the high culture or the elite culture, which also is exported. But they're sort of two different things, as though they were totally different objects. There is probably a growing confluence of those two cultures, if you like. There's a lot of crossover. There's a lot of cross-fertilization. There's a lot of sort of transmutation. I mean, Chorus Line started out as a nonprofit theater project, all right, at the New York Shakespeare Festival. It then became one of the longest-running successful Broadway shows. I mean, that kind of transference, goes on all the time. And again, maybe one of the things that we also need to consider after 25 years of some kind of cultural policy is that culture can't be segmented that way. It's both, and that if we're concerned with exporting America's image, you also have to consider the commercial culture. If there is a crossover, some people have argued that fine arts are sort of R&D for the commercial arts. And if that's the case, then there's a different reason for sort of supporting it, because then it's the investment payoff later on that happens in the commercial arts. Works the other way too. Stuff developed in the commercial sector sort of gets refined and rarefied in the high sector as well. Maybe it's the confluence of those things, not that they're different, but that they're all American culture, and if we're really going to have a cultural policy, you can't stop with the nonprofit arts and the high arts. You have to go beyond that.
Maybe we should stop now, and Dr. Wizomarski will be lecturing at the Federal Executive Institute, so that's not far from the Miller Center, being just down the road, and she's asked to be put on her mailing list. The fact that this subject continues to preoccupy your thinking is illustrated by what for me is a unique experience. I've had letters and phone calls before we had this phone call. And they represented both poles of the view. One person said he was so pleased that Nancy Hanks had started what she had started, and that there was a great role. Look what's happening in Germany and France and other countries. Why shouldn't the United States have funding of the arts? And then I got a letter from a good friend. I have a question for the October 10th forum, which you've already answered. The question is this. A lot of taxpayers agree with Senator Helms, and I have strong objections to being involuntary contributors to art like Mapplethorpe's. Why shouldn't the government leave support of art entirely to private voluntary contributions and foundation grants? So there you have it, at two poles, and that'll be the subject of our next forum with you. Oh, and if I mentioned to some of you this excellent